Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who has both casual and formal golf shoes, Charlie Nance.
Welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. This week is the first of two holiday weeks surrounding the 4th of July. On today's show, we'll revisit a conversation we had right before the last Summer Olympiad with Michael Cochran, who wrote a fascinating book about the original Olympic golf gold medalist, Canadian George Lyon. Also, in honor of the U.S. Senior Open being contested this week, we'll look back to a visit a year ago with Captain Bob Desjardins, one of the top senior golfers in the Carolinas, who once upon a time competed in the Senior Open. But we begin today with our friend from the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, Ron Green Jr. Ron, who is Bubba Watson, and is there a player or a hybrid of players that he reminds you of? As I was watching the end of the tournament, the Travelers the other day, that's what I just kept thinking. Who is it that this guy reminds me of? And I have an idea, but I want to see who you think.
I got to believe he is, I mean, he's a one mold model or whatever it is. I mean, I don't know that he reminds me of anybody. I mean, I think, between personality and playing style, I'm interested to hear who you compare him to because, are you going to say John Daly?
No. I had the fortune to play in a pro-am one time with Chichi Rodriguez, and I don't think I ever saw Chichi hit a straight shot or not try to move the ball six ways from Sunday with every club in the bag all the time. And just strictly in the movement of the golf ball and the way that they may see a golf course differently than the rest of us, that's who he kind of reminds me of because, you know, like I said, that day with Chichi was a clinic in how never to hit a ball straight.
Yeah, well, he certainly does that. I mean, I saw a lot of sort of references after the tournament the other day about how Bubba sort of paints his way around the golf course, and he does. I mean, the last thing he ever wants to hit is just a plain old straight, ordinary shot. And it doesn't matter which way he wants to turn it. I think he likes to hit his version of a cut out there. But he's a unique personality, a unique talent. And, I mean, he just keeps rolling along. I remember it wasn't long ago we were talking to him about, okay, you said you're going to retire after 10 wins. What would happen if you got there? Well, now he's blown on past that, and he's getting up there into some, you know, pretty select company now.
Is there any reason, given his past history, and I don't mean this to be a knock against him at all, to think that he could be a factor at any major other than Augusta? I keep thinking that perhaps he could be a factor at an Open Championship, but I don't know if it's one of these things that he just talks himself out of it.
Well, I think there's no doubt he talks himself out of some big tournaments. I think he did it at Pinehurst number 2. You could listen to his comments before the tournament. You could just say, well, he's not going to win. Open Championship's the one I would think of, I think, because it requires imagination. Now, it requires you to be patient sometimes to sort of do what it asks. And, you know, I think sometimes the temptation for him is to maybe want to do, you know, overdo what he does. But I could see him winning at an Open Championship. I think he has enough different kinds of shots, and obviously – if you get the typical weather there, you've got to be able to control it in the wind and everything. And I think he can do that. But, you know, I think he's grown into quite a player, especially considering where we were a year ago where we didn't talk about him.
That's what I was thinking, that if he perhaps wins a big tournament, maybe not even a major, but a WGC or something, and gets to 4 or 5 wins for the year, we're not just talking about the stone cold lead pipe lock for comeback player of the year, but also player of the year at the same time, and you rarely see those two awards go to the same person.
Yeah, I think he's building as strong a case as anybody right now. Now, he hadn't won a major this year, but for player of the year, we got good chunk of the meat of the schedule left here to sort of determine all that, but he's right there. And I know some people want to ascribe it to the golf ball. I don't know. I think that was probably some of it, but I think the whatever his health issue was, his distraction and everything, I think he's got himself in a good place. And when he got it going there Sunday at Hartford, I mean, he just kept taking it deeper and deeper.
Yeah, I'm not one to want to give Titleist that big a commercial and ascribe it totally to the golf ball. Now, I think that perhaps his health and new equipment may have led to a severe loss in confidence. And you're a golfer. I'm a golfer. The second you don't believe you can do it, I can promise you, you can't. And I think that probably led to his problems more than anything else. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer is our guest taking Dead Aim. Thank you for bringing up the word schedule. I saw a little blurb that you wrote this week, and it really gave me pause when I thought about it. At this time next year, we will have already been through three major championships and the TPC, and we will be within, what, less than 60 days of the season wrapping up?
Well, you know, however, August 25th is what I keep hearing. I think July 10th is when they're going to release the schedule, but I'm hearing, you know, the last full weekend in August is where what they're pointing toward to end it there. And so, yeah, it would be, whatever, 3 weeks from the Open Championship, and that would be the end of the major championship season. Then I think we would go from there, they'd fly back to Memphis to do the WGC, then play Wyndham, play their two playoff events in the Tour Championship, and call it a season. And next year, the President's Cup won't be till December down in Australia. So then you'll have quite a different sort of schedule situation.
Yeah, they might actually have, at that point, I forgot about the President's Cup being down under. They could have almost a month off completely before the start of the new season.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to want to go that long without having a tournament, but I think they're going to go a long time. And then they're going to take a month in Asia. I don't know if that's October or exactly when. I haven't looked. But once we're all dialed into watching the college and NFL seasons.
Ron, I had somebody ask me last week, and I promised that I would ask you because you would know, and if it's happened and slipped my attention, I apologize. There was talk about making maybe one or two slight adjustments to Quail Hollow after we got done with the Wells Fargo a few weeks ago. Have they made those changes yet, or are they working on them?
I know they have made an adjustment to the fourth green, there's a bunker on the left side of the fourth green in the front there. They significantly lowered the lip of that one and flattened out that portion of the green. Probably to the average person who goes out there won't notice all that much difference, but I think to the players it's sort of what they complain the most about. So they fixed that. I think they have a new tee on number 15. I want to say they moved it 10 yards back and maybe 10 yards closer to the 14th green, sort of down to the left. I have not seen it, but I've been told that, and I think they've done a couple other little tweaks, nothing major. But that's, as I understand it, that's what's been done.
Middle of last week, Ron, we lost two World Golf Hall of Fame members and two distinctly different individuals, but I liked them both, and I was especially fond of Hubert Green, 19-time winner on the PGA Tour, two-time major champion. I had a couple of dealings with him when I was living in Birmingham with the Champions Tour event that would come and be there. I want you to speak first to Hubert Green, your memories of him and your experiences being around him.
I remember talking to him up at the Champions event they had at Rock Barn a couple of times. Didn't know him, wouldn't claim to know him, but watched him a lot, obviously, through his prime and what he did Southern Hills with the death threat and all that, went in the U.S. Open, and then coming back in whatever it was, 8 years later, went in the PGA at Cherry Hills. I mean, he's a terrific player. I mean, there's a reason he's in the Hall of Fame. Sort of, what do you call it, you know, homemade golf swing, played it his own way, nobody would ever say, here you go, look at this, that's how you swing a golf club.
No.
But he made it work, and then around the greens, I mean, he had hands, and he could just hit all kinds of shots. I mean, he was truly one of the great short game players. And, you know, the way people talk about Seve and Tiger and Phil, and I mean, Hubert Green in his way was just exceptional around there. And that's that and his grit and tenacity. I mean, he was sort of, you know, tough as new rope, I think, and just had a way of getting it done. What did he win, 19 times in two majors, I think.
Yeah, and the other is Peter Thompson. Most of his stuff was done in the 50s and 60s. Did not play a whole lot in America. Won a few times on the Senior/Champions Tour. But, you know, five times a winner at the Open Championship. Quite a player and maybe the best links player of all time, according to Tom Watson. Did you ever have an instance to speak with him?
I didn't speak with him, but I saw him a few times and knew of his reputation, of his record and all that, and his sort of place in the game. I think he was just the classic golf gentleman. Let everything speak for itself. in our magazine this week, Louise Mayer, who lives over in Edinburgh, she wrote a beautiful column about him and some time she had with him. And about 10 or 12 years ago, she went to his home and sat there and talked with him one afternoon and just, you know, I mean, he's the guy who would still, at that age, would go put his clubs on his shoulder and go out and play late in the day and just keep going, you know, ageless in a way. Played that Champions Tour thing and the Champions Celebration or something at the Open.
Oh, yeah, where they have all the past champions come out and play like a six-hole tournament or something, yeah.
Yeah, and I think I saw him there. It's most memorable because Arnie hit a shot there at the Old Course and played the first hole there and then sort of rode around the rest of the way. I'm thinking I saw Peter Thompson play there, and I'm sure I saw him play at what did they used to call the Champions? See, I've already learned to call it the Champions now rather than the Seniors, but, you know, the Home Depot Championship or whatever we had here.
Oh, yeah.
Back through the years at Piper Glen and at Quail Hollow, I know I saw Peter Thompson some there.
Safe to say that although Greg Norman seems to get a lot of the credit for the popularity of Australian golf, that maybe Peter Thompson was sort of the Arnold Palmer of golf in Australia, since Norman had to have looked up to him.
And I would say that, and unfortunately, we have never had to see Peter Thompson posing the body issue of ESPN. And if I have to see one more of those things, I'm a big fan of Greg Norman. I really am. And he's been very nice to me. I've gotten to spend a good bit of time with him. But enough's enough. It's just like, okay. We know you're still ripped and all that, but I could have done without that.
Yeah, for God's sakes, keep your pants on. Ron Green-Jugger with the Global Golf Post, the Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. A couple of quick ones to get you out of here. I mentioned the piece that you wrote where you sort of blurped about the schedule next year. This week, the Quicken Loans in Washington, D.C., this is a farewell. Next year, this tournament moves up to the Quicken Loans home office back in Detroit, where I guess we haven't had a tournament in suburban Detroit since the old Buick tournament that was up there?
Yeah, I remember being up at Oakland Hills for a Ryder Cup, and they had some PGAs up there. But, yeah, I can't remember exactly when the last Buick Open was. It was very popular. And, yeah, I think this is going to be the Country Club of Detroit, and they're moving it up there. And, there's two spots in the schedule where I'm not exactly sure what's falling where. The Detroit event is one of them, and the other one is the new one in Minneapolis, St. Paul, that's coming on next year. Now with Houston moving out to the fall schedule and all that stuff. So those are the last little pieces. So it's not only is the schedule going to look different, but it's going to go to a couple different places.
And obviously those two events have to be played in the summer. You can't fool around in the fall with Detroit and Minnesota. Where in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, what course would they be playing there?
You know, I'm not positive. I saw the release, and I don't even know if it named it, but if it did, it is just slipping my mind right now. But, I mean, that's a huge golf area up there. I mean, we may not think of it immediately, but I know from being at Hazeltine and PGAs and things up there, I mean, that's golf is a huge thing up there. And they've had for years, their seniors event was one of the most successful, drew really, really good crowds and all that. And so I think that's a place that's been looking for a tournament. So good for them getting one.
Woke up Sunday morning. Get you out of here finally on this. Woke up Sunday morning and flipped on the golf channel, and they had the BMW International being played in Germany. And one of my favorite names in golf, Torbjörn Olsen, Thunder Bear, had gone out, was 2 over par heading into the last round, shot 11 under, and was at 9 under par. He was in the lead for most of the day, and you never saw him take one shot because he went out so early. He wound up one behind the winner. But I wrote this down because I wanted to ask you, what was the longest clubhouse wait you ever saw a guy have to make to win a golf tournament?
Good question. I don't know. I mean, who was just having to wait for a long time recently? But I don't know. There's been a few. I was trying to think, like, how early did Johnny Miller go out in that U.S. Open?
Well,
I mean, he was an hour or so in it out.
Yeah, that name was brought up that he may have been out an hour to 2 hours, been done before the winners, but or before the last group got done. But yeah, I was sitting there going, this guy has been in the house for four and a half hours. If he has to go out and do a playoff, this is like starting a brand new day for him.
When Rory won that first tournament at Wells Fargo, I mean, I remember all I saw him play was the 18th hole because it sort of happened, you know, remember he had made the cut on the number and he was not really that much of a thought. And then he goes out and shoots at 63 or whatever on Sunday afternoon, and he sort of had to go catch up with him, and all these other guys never got back to him. I want to say he was an hour and a half at least in front of him.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr. And up next, we look back to a fascinating subject just prior to golf's return to the Summer Olympics with author Michael Cochran as he takes dead aim at golf's first gold medalist, George Lyon, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We are taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Back just prior to golf's return to the Summer Olympics in 2016, I had the chance to talk with author Michael Cochran about a book he'd written about the first and last gold medalist in golf, Canadian George Lyon.
As an American, there are certain national sports legends that we grow up knowing. Babe Ruth, Jesse Owens, Jackie Robinson, and golf, Bobby Jones. We all know those names. Is George Lyon's name and story, is it on that level for a Canadian?
No, I wish it was. George Lyon's story really has been lost in the mists of time for some reason up here. I think in part that may be because the Olympic tradition didn't really follow for golf. You know, in 1904, they had the competition, they awarded a cup, they awarded a gold medal, but there was no follow-up like there is with a green jacket or a claret jug and other trophies. So for some reason, his story got lost.
What was that Olympic golf tournament like in 1904? You haven't heard anything about it. What were the parameters? How many people were in it? How many competed? How many countries?
It was quite an event. Newspaper counts at the time, which incidentally were extremely detailed. You know, those were the days when you'd get a morning newspaper and an afternoon newspaper. Golf journalists covered the Olympics very, very closely. They would have newspaper accounts that talked shot for shot what each player had done on each hole in great detail. So for me, in writing the book, I was able to call on a lot of that information to make the story completely accurate and authentic. But the way that the tournament evolved was originally intended to be in 1903 as just an international competition. But when St. Louis got the World's Fair for 1904, the organizers and owners, co-founders of Glen Echo Golf Course in St. Louis, offered to postpone their international competition to 1904 so that the golf sport could be a part of those 1904 Olympics, which were the first Summer Olympics, first Olympics ever to be in North America. So Golf Illustrated magazine sent out an invitation worldwide, and that invitation said, if you're an amateur golfer, you are welcome to come to St. Louis, Missouri, and we're going to have a qualifying round on Monday, September 19th, 1904. And the top 32 golfers are going to be able to go forward into medal competition over the balance of the week. And about 75 golfers showed up, 32 qualified. And people need to understand that in 1904, they were not doing a stroke play event. Match play was the way that they had their competition. So on the Monday, they tracked scores for a medal competition.
So that's how they narrowed the field, was with medal play to start with?
Exactly.
Okay.
And then those 32 went forward into match play competition over the balance of the week. And then day by day by day, people would be eliminated, and last man standing gets the gold medal. That was George Lyon.
But it was complete individual competition. You were like George Lyon was representing Canada, but there wasn't a team Canada golf.
That's right. And interesting thing about the Olympics at that time, because the modern Olympics had started in 1896 in Greece, then they went to Paris in 1900, and then they came to St. Louis in 1904. Those previous Summer Olympics never really had team competitions where you'd have a team, for example, come from England or a team from France. There were usually sports associations that sent athletes or individuals would show up to compete. The first time you start to see national teams show up are actually in some sports in St. Louis. So, for example, we had a a lacrosse team come from Canada, Winnipeg, Canada, down to St. Louis, and they won the gold medal for lacrosse that year in 1904. But a lot of people were just showing up as individuals, and that was particularly the case with golf. George Lyon came down to St. Louis with a couple of his golf buddies from Lambton Golf Course here in Toronto, and they turned out to be the only internationals who showed up. Nobody else came from England or Scotland or Australia, anywhere else.
Well, in all fairness, international travel not as easy in 1904 as it is today. You know, a lot of people will argue that that was a pretty good model to do the Olympics, only if you would extend it to teams today with golf instead of having it an individual medal play.
Michael Cochran is the author. The book is called Olympic Lyon. It's the story of George Lyon, the first person to win a gold medal in the Olympics back in 1904. He's our guest taking Dead Aim.
Let's talk a little bit about George Lyon himself. In 1904, George was not exactly a young man or even an experienced golfer, but he was a tremendous athlete.
Yeah. Yeah, in 1904, he was 46 years of age, so he was the same age when he won the gold medal that Jack Nicklaus was when he won the Masters the last time in 86.
That's right. That's what Jack have in common. At 46, he won the Masters, and I'm talking to you.
Exactly.
Major accomplishments in life for both of us, just a little different.
Yeah, so George Lyon was, by all accounts, a natural athlete. He was pretty well known in sports circles in Toronto at the turn of the last century. I'm talking about like around 1895 or so. He played baseball, football, hockey, curling, track and field, and in particular cricket. He was a real cricket player. And he had been waiting one day to play some cricket with his buddies, and they were late, and a friend said, "Hey, why don't you try golf?" And he said, "You know, I don't really not." He actually had a mild contempt for the sport because the guys dressed kind of funny. They didn't seem to be a lot of action. They were playing on what was almost like a cow pasture in Toronto. But he took the challenge up, and he went out and played nine holes and just fell head over heels in love with golf. So at that time, he was 38. And within 2 years, he was Canada's amateur champion and went on to be a huge force in Canadian golf, winning our Canadian amateur championship eight times and winning the Canadian senior amateur championship numerous times, and also holding both the Canadian senior amateur championship and the American amateur championship at the same time on four occasions.
So he was an American equivalent for us. He was like Jim Thorpe. He was like Bo Jackson. He was just a natural athlete. Whatever he picked up, he seemingly not only could play, but excel at.
Yeah, he was like that, and those are good analogies. But there was a golfer in the U.S. at that time, a guy named Walter Travis, who went on to become a fairly well-known golf course architect. But Walter Travis was a guy who also came to golf very late in life, probably took up golf within about 6 months of George Lyon taking up in Canada. And Walter Travis was a very tough cookie, you know, as an athlete. He was into bicycling and fishing and hunting and a lot of other sports, but he took to golf and fell in love with it the same way that George Lyon did, and became a really dominant force in American golf.
Michael Cochran is the author. The book is called Olympic Lyon. It's the story of George Lyon, the first person to win a gold medal in the Olympics back in 1904. He's our guest taking Dead Aim.
In this country, there's been a couple of golf renaissances that are traceable to charismatic players. Bobby Jones, Arnold Palmer, Tiger Woods. What was or is George's impact on the game of golf in Canada?
Well, those are all spectacular names, and I should mention that Bobby Jones was 2 years old in 1904 when George Lyon won his gold medal. So George Lyon really predates all of these players. But I would say, you know, when people in Canada now think about our great athletes, we tend to think of it, particularly in golf, of Mike Weir. We also like to think now of Brooke Henderson, our young
she's fantastic.
Female golfer fantastic. And interestingly, she grew up about 100 miles from where George Lyon was born and grew up. So interesting that there might be a couple of gold medalists that come from a very small part of the world. But we think about Mike Weir. We think about Wayne Gretzky. And, Sidney Crosby, other great athletes like that. But I guess part of the problem is that, in terms of renaissance in sport and renaissance in golf, we're waiting for that next great name to come along to really give us a renaissance movement in golf in Canada. Maybe that's going to be Brooke Henderson.
Maybe so. We'll hit on another name here in a second because I wanted to ask you about last weekend at the Canadian Open. But when Lyon returned home from St. Louis, from the 1904 Olympics, a gold medalist for the country of Canada, how was he feted by the country? Where, in our country back in those days, there would be a ticker tape parade in New York City. How was he feted in Canada?
He really received a hero's welcome. Most of the travel at that time was by train. And he took a train from Toronto, down private rail car, paid for by one of his wealthy buddies, took a rail car down to St. Louis and back. And when he arrived in Toronto, he received a hero's welcome at our big train station here. And he was feted by the city and by the club members. They had dinners, and the city presented him with a silver bowl. And his name was prominent. He was a big name in sports generally in Canada. And then gradually, over time, that just disappeared. And, another interesting thing that people should be aware of is back at this time, amateurism was very, very important.
Oh, to be a professional golfer was to be signing up to be a second-class citizen.
Absolutely. And we had an incident here in Toronto just a couple of years before George Lyon headed off to play in the Olympics. There was a young hockey player here in Toronto, a guy named Jack Carmichael, who made the mistake of accepting some money to play in a hockey game. And he was shunned socially. His picture was in the front page of our Toronto Daily News. He lost a job offer. He was prevented from playing on any sports teams, and he was shunned in social circles. That's how much they looked down on professional athletes at that time. So for George Lyon to be an amateur at that time was successful was a pretty big deal.
Michael, in your research, what happened to golf in the Olympics? I mean, it seemed like it was a fairly big deal and widely reported in 1904, but it disappeared. Why is that?
People, golfers, have a lot of trouble agreeing on the rules. We probably saw a bit of that with the USGA over the last few tournaments. Men and women having trouble with these rules. But that's what was going on back even in 1900, and particularly 1904 when they had the Olympics in St. Louis. But when they were supposed to return to London, England in 1908, the Royal and Ancient and other golf associations got into an argument about what rules they were going to use, who would qualify, would it be stroke play, would it be match play, and the organizers of the Olympics said, we had enough of this. If you guys can't agree on the rules, then we're not going to have golf. And that's how it got dropped.
Good gosh almighty. Even back then, the USGA causing issues. My goodness.
Michael Cochran is the author. The book is called Olympic Lyon. It's the story of George Lyon, the first person to win a gold medal in the Olympics back in 1904. He's our guest taking Dead Aim.
You mentioned earlier about perhaps Brooke Henderson could be the focal point of a renaissance in golf in Canada. And Mike Weir is a major champion. And I remember the tremendous pressure that Mike Weir used to put on himself to win the Canadian Open. No Canadian has won the Canadian Open since 1954. Just this last weekend, there was an amateur whose name is Dutoit who was right there on Sunday. How big a deal is that each year in the sports media that no Canadian has won the Canadian Open? And was Dutoit under an intense amount of pressure for an amateur last weekend?
I think he was under a lot of pressure. And, you know, it's funny that probably more Canadian golfers know the name Pat Fletcher than they do George Lyon, because Pat Fletcher was the last Canadian to win our Canadian Open. And I think of that year that Mike Weir faced Vijay Singh coming down the stretch, and Vijay ended up beating him, and he almost looked sheepish.
He did. He looked disappointed that he had won. It was very, very bizarre.
The last thing that Vijay needed was another victory, and he knew how big it was for Mike Weir, but that was a huge disappointment for people. And I think that Dutoit, you know, he really fired up interest in the Canadian Open this year. It was terrific for golf and for his name, and I think we're going to see a lot more of him.
The book is called Olympic Lion, the author Michael Cochran, and when we return, in honor of the United States Senior Open being held this week, we revisit our conversation from a year ago with my friend and Carolina senior golfing icon, Captain Bob Desjardins, as he takes dead aim at his experience playing in the U.S. Senior Open. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Hey, we're taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. The United States Senior Open is being held at the Broadmoor in Colorado this weekend, and a year ago, I had the chance to talk about playing in this event with Captain Bob Desjardins, who once upon a time did just that. Now, were you a golfer growing up, or did you take it up later on as an adult?
No, my dad started me when I was probably seven, and... But I was playing everything at that point, you know, baseball and basketball and football. And then I did play during the summer. I did play in some junior events around town. And when we got to high school, we kind of laid off golf because I was really concentrating on other sports at that point. And then once we got back into college, we started playing again. And just started playing a lot more after that.
Now, I know you're an uber competitive guy. How long was it after you took up the game again in college that you started to get down, you know, to around scratch and to the competitive levels that you've been at for as long as I've known you?
That was after I got out of the Navy. And I got hired by the airlines in 78. And when you get working with the airlines, the first thing you do, you're on reserve. And so they may call you, they may not call you. And so when they weren't calling me, there were a couple of facilities around our house that I was able to practice at. And so I got in a lot of practice at that point. And that's when the handicap started marching toward zero. And at that point, we really started to take it seriously as far as being an amateur.
Now, was this when you were living in San Diego, or where were you then?
Yeah, we were in San Diego at this point.
Bob Desjardins, a former participant in the United States Senior Open, is our guest taking dead aim. Now, at this time, you've told me stories before. When did you meet Billy Casper, and you played a couple of rounds of golf with him?
Well, I met Billy at San Diego Country Club. I joined there in the mid-'80s, and he was at San Diego Country Club for a very, very long time, and he was playing there. I played one day with a real good friend of his, and he said, how would you like to play with Billy sometime? And I said, well, I'd love to. So he set it up, and the next week, you know, it was my first opportunity to play with Billy Casper, so that was really cool.
Were you intimidated at all, or were you pretty confident in what you were doing at that point, or was it weird? What was that feeling like?
Well, it was, I was so psyched up to play that first round of golf with him that I showed up early and I warmed up and I putted and I chipped and I did everything. I was so ready to go. And while I'm doing all of this, Billy's in the clubhouse eating lunch.
So he's not nearly as psyched up to play you as you are to play him.
Can you believe that? So we get to the first tee and he says, Bob, how about you leading us off? And I said, okay, fine. So I got up there, and I hit one as good as I could hit one, right down the middle. And he gets up there, and he does a couple of stretches. He has not hit a ball yet. and kind of stretches his back a little bit, okay, and then tees it up and hits it 10 yards by me.
Should have had lunch.
Yeah, should have had lunch. That's not the best part. The best part is, after I hit one on the green, he hits 9-iron in the hole.
Oh, you're kidding.
No. So the very first hole I played with Billy Casper, he makes eagle.
So at this point, you're out. I'm trying to gauge your psyche, starting to think towards, you know, what can I qualify for? You're out of the range really to do the USAM. Did you ever have thoughts of trying to qualify for the mid am, or did you try?
I never did try that, simply because I couldn't dedicate enough time to go to a tournament like that because I was a working stiff, and so it really didn't come into play. All of my golf was basically in the San Diego area, maybe occasionally up in L.A.
Bob Desjardins is our guest, taking Dead Aim, a former participant in the United States Senior Open. You played in the 99 Senior Open at Des Moines Golf and Country Club. And one of the things I found interesting in thinking about this is, unlike the regular U.S. Open, distance and size, of course, doesn't really matter. So the USGA can take the Senior Open just about anywhere. That being said, couldn't have been that exciting to go to Des Moines, Bob.
Well, I'll tell you what. I had a friend that had played in the Senior Open the year before when it was in L.A. at Riviera. And the people in L.A. were just kind of so-so with this tournament because there's so many things to do in L.A.
Right.
Well, we got to Des Moines, and they had never seen anything like this. And they came out, and they were the best fans. They were just autograph seekers like crazy. It couldn't have been a better venue to have gone to play a big tournament like this, because the people were wonderful.
Yeah, you know, you're right. The circus doesn't come to town very often, so when it does, everybody wants to see it and reach out and touch it. Before we hit on the Open itself, I want to talk about qualifying for the United States Senior Open. So how far in advance did you try to qualify before? Or was 1999 the first year you tried?
No, that was the first year I tried. It was the first year I was eligible.
So you turn 50 and you try for the Senior Open. This is a process that's much, I don't want to say easier because that diminishes it, and I don't mean it to, but the process of qualifying for the U.S. Open starts with 9,000 people and local qualifying over 36 holes, and then you have sectional qualifying over 36 holes, and at the end of the day, you know, you've got 70 spots from 9,000 people. It's just incredibly daunting. Qualifying for the Senior Open is a lot different and a lot, let's just say, a lot more basic, right?
Well, it sure is. Compared to the U.S. Open, you're talking about one qualifying site. So you go, and if you qualify that day, you're in. There were 100 guys trying to qualify at my site, and we qualified 3 people.
Wow. So 3 spots for 100?
Yeah.
Is it a 36-hole qualifier or just 18?
Oh, no. This is a senior qualifying. Come on. We can only play 18.
Now, did you know where you stood? Was there live scoring with you as you went around?
No, absolutely not. The only time I was toward the end of the groupings, and I thought the number was going to be somewhere like 4 under par. And I came to the 17th hole, and I was 3 under par, and our 17th hole was that day was a par 5. And so I went for it in 2 and left it off to the right of the green and messed the chip up. To make a long story short, I bogeyed this par 5. So now I'm back to 2 under, and I go to the 18th hole, hit it in the fairway, hit it on the green, and there's a buddy of mine up on the patio. And I walked up before I putted, and I said, "What kind of scores are in?" He says, "There's a 69, which is 300, and then a bunch of 72s. I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "How do you stand?" And I said, "Well, I'm 2 under right now." He says, "Well, just 2 putt, and I think you're looking pretty good." So I had about 20 feet or so, and I got up there, and I knocked the putt up. And it wasn't a bad putt. It was probably a foot and a half that I had left. and I marked it, and I let the other guys finish. And I put the ball back down, and Chuck, to this day, I have no idea how the ball went in the hole because my hands were shaking so hard. The putter was just wobbling like crazy, and somehow I hit it on the right jerk and got it in the hole and qualified.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, when it hit you, the enormity of the situation you were in, of what was at stake, or, you know, you probably were better off if you'd have never gone up and said anything to your buddy and just finished out the hole.
Yeah, absolutely. If I would have just not known a thing, I would have gone up there, lagged it up, tapped it in, and, you know, we're done with it. But having known, it certainly got the nerves going.
What would it have been like if you'd have found out where you stood before you teed off on 18? I asked this because I had Scott Harvey on the show a few weeks ago talking about qualifying for the U.S. Open. And on 18, he knew that he had a stroke to play with, and it was a par four, and he put the driver back in the bag, and he played it as a par five, and he hit five iron, a wedge, and then chipped it up and two putted for bogey, and that was it. If you'd have known where you stood, would you have played it differently, or do you think it would have been like that putt, only starting at the tee box?
I probably would have played it the same way, hitting driver and hitting the second shot, because there were still groups behind me that I didn't know how they stood. And as it turned out, there was one guy that shot one under, and then there was another guy that was at even par. So I probably would have played it the same, because I still had to play hard.
Bob Desjardins is a former participant in the United States Senior Open. He participated in the one in 1999 at Des Moines Golf and Country Club. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. So let's get to Des Moines Golf and Country Club. Do you arrive the weekend before, or when do you get there?
I got there Sunday afternoon, the week before, and just checked in. And then Monday was my first practice round.
What was it like the first time you walk out on the driving range at a United States, a USGA Open, so the Senior Open, and someone walks out with a cardboard placard and sticks it, on your slot. There is Robert Desjardins, and it hits you. Oh, my God, I'm actually here, and I'm actually doing this.
Well, my son and I were walking out to the driving range, and before I could get to the driving range, these people started mobbing me, and I had to sign autographs. And this was the kind of attitude that they had in Des Moines. They were going crazy. And this is Monday. And so I told my son, I said, go find a spot on the range. I'll meet you there as soon as I can. And it was at least 20 minutes before I could finish with all the signing just to get to the driving range.
Did any of the legitimate celebrities that were, you know, professional golfers see you signing these things and just laugh?
No, because everybody was signing. I mean, these people, if you had a golf bag, you were going to sign autographs. It was crazy. The practice rounds, you signed between every green to the next tee. And then when we finished the practice rounds, it was 40 minutes before I could get to the clubhouse.
Did you take the opportunity to play a practice round with one of these guys that you've admired your whole life? Or who did you play with?
I did on Wednesday. I had an opportunity to play with Graham Marsh.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, who had played and had won the Senior Open a couple of years before. And that was a lot of fun. It was just Graham and I. And we went out and played 18 holes. And what a gentleman. We had a real special day that day.
Your name gets announced on the first tee on Thursday. Which was more of a nerve-wracking moment, making the putt to actually qualify or hitting that first tee shot at the United States Senior Open?
You know, that tee shot wasn't as bad as the tee shot that I hit on Monday of the practice round.
Really?
Because you have to understand, it's Monday, the practice round, there's nobody around. There had to be 2,000 people around the first tee, and they were announcing you to the first tee. on Monday.
On the practice rounds?
The practice round.
Wow.
Now, my worst fear comes right in front of me. They announce the guy that I'm going to play with, and he gets up there, and he has my nightmare. My nightmare is dribbling the ball off the tee.
Oh.
And he does it. And
that's all that's in your head.
Oh, and then he announces me, and then I get up there, and I'm hitting a three wood because it's a short little dogleg right par four, and I go through my routine. I tee the ball up. I go through my routine. I get over the ball. I hit the ball. I look up, and I don't see a thing. But it felt pretty good.
Right.
So I went back to my son, and I said, "Where'd it go?" He said, "Hey, Dad, it was really good, right down the middle." He said, "How did you get the ball to stay on the tee? Your hands were shaking."
I can imagine. So at the end of two rounds, you don't make the cut. How far are you off the number?
I believe, and don't hold me to this, but I believe the number was, I want to say six over, something like six or seven over.
Yeah.
And I was not close. I shot 80, 81, I believe.
Were you really disappointed in your play, or did it not really matter to you? You were like, man, I got here.
I was disappointed to some degree because normally my strength is driving the ball in the fairway. And I missed so many fairways in 2 days, and I just, that's where I was losing strokes. And so I was disappointed in that. And I was hitting a lot of good iron shots, but the iron shots, you're in the fairway and you're away from the people. On the tee, everybody's right around you. And it's just not being used to the environment of having that many people that close to you trying to hit golf shots.
Pop quiz. Do you know who finished runner-up that year?
Oh, boy.
I could probably sit here all day and you'd never get this.
I know Hale Irwin was in the hunt, but I don't think he finished second. I think he was like top five or something like that.
Ed Dougherty.
Dougherty, that's right, because I talked to him on the range one day, and, I mean, the guy's got forearms like, I mean.
Popeye.
Like a lumberjack.
Yeah.
But that's right. He did. He's right there at the end.
Now, do you remember who won?
You know, I knew you were going to ask me that question. I've been thinking about it.
Because you blew it on first runner-up.
I know. And I can picture him because I walked right by him when he had the trophy in his hand.
Well, you photobombed his trophy celebration?
No. Now, back in those days, there was no such thing as photobombing.
Dave Eichelberger won the 1999 Senior Open.
That's right. That's exactly right. That was a pretty big upset, actually, because Eichelberger was a pro for a long time, but he's not one of those names that you would think that would be winning a Senior Open.
Bob Desjardins is a participant in the 1999 United States Senior Open. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here on this. The story famously is that your two-day total was actually lower than the late, great Arnold Palmer's. Is that correct?
That is correct, but it has a little bit of an asterisk by it.
Okay.
On his 36th hole, he putted up to about 3 feet, and then he sort of straddled the line and hit it with the end of his putter into the hole. And the USGA, in their infinite wisdom, decided to throw two shots on him, and that's the reason I beat him.
All right, get you out of here on this, and this is a big, important question.
Oh, God.
What means more to you in your life right now, the fact that you can always say that you beat Arnold Palmer, or would it mean more to you if you actually were able to win a beer off of me this weekend?
Oh, no, there's no question about this. I want that beer, and I want...
Ha, 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 ha,
That's Carolina senior golfing icon and my friend, Captain Bob Desjardins. I'd also like to thank author Michael Cochran and from the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, Ron Green Jr. for their time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks just minutes after this version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. And on that page right now is a quick link to the new video component to Taking Dead Aim. If you fear bunkers, you'll want to check it out. Hey, weather-wise, it's a scorcher in the Carolinas, but still perfect to get your golf on this weekend. And if you do tee it up and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.